2017. This says 2016. y'all are just testing me, and the time is 10:13 a.m. I now call this meeting of the Finance Commission to order pursuant to Chapter 551 of the Government Code. There is a quorum with 10 members present. Bob Borchoff did contact me and indicated that he could attend yesterday and briefly this morning, but that he would not be able to attend our regular meeting and has requested that his absence be excused. In accordance with the Finance Code 11.103, the Commission members will take a vote to either accept or deny this request. All in favor of excusing the absence, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and that absence is excused, if you would just make sure the record reflects that. Thank you. Before we dive into Finance Commission matters, a few things that I'd just like to mention this morning. Firstly, would like to welcome Charles back on the job from a very successful surgery, not as a pleasant recovery, which from his surgery the first week of January. So, albeit he may be moving a little slower right now, the goal is for him to be moving a lot quicker soon. And then yesterday, we held a rather unusual briefing session for the commission. During our open regular meetings, it's very difficult to take 2 hours into the agenda and try to help the new members get acclimated and to update the old members. And so the agencies prepared a briefing for us yesterday, and in particular, just wanted to thank all three commissioners from all three agencies, and in particular, not the duck that's quacking. Do like the ringtone, though. But the people from each agency who were very informative, which from Department of Banking was Kurt Purdom and Russell Reese, from Savings and Mortgage Lending, Patsy Smith, Stephen O'Shields, and Tony Florence, and from OCCC, Rudy Aguilar, and I'm going to destroy this, I know, Iman Briggs, who, by the way, yesterday was the first time that he approached the commission, and I should have commended him on that yesterday. So thank you all for that. It was very informative, and the feedback's already been very good from the members that I've spoken to. Moving on to the first item on the agenda, on consent are the minutes from our last December meeting, which are found from pages 9 through 13. We don't have any public comment?
No.
Okay. So we will move on to the consent agenda, which you will find on page 15. Members, before we take up the consent agenda, which is A1 and B2, I want to state that any commission member can request that an agenda item be removed from the consent agenda and placed on the regular agenda so that it can be discussed and voted on individually. Hearing no objections from any members, do I hear a motion to adopt the following consent agenda items without discussion, A1 and B2?
So moved.
Molly, is there a second?
Second.
Second from Will. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
The ayes, any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion passes. Agenda item 4, which is Finance Commission Operations. Commissioner Cooper.
Thank you. Okay, the legislative session, I would say, is in full swing. This is the first time we've kind of talked about the detail. On the Senate side, the two committees that we deal with, primarily Business and Commerce, that is chaired by Kelly Hancock, and then on the finance side, Chair Jane Nelson returns there. And then recently, the investment on the House side, investment in financial services, those members were appointed, and Tan Parker comes back as chair. Phil Stevenson is the vice chair, and on the committee we have some, I guess, a combination of some new and some people that have been there before. So for those of y'all that have been nominated and we're still waiting confirmation by the Senate, nothing has been scheduled yet. It's possible that you could be called to testify at the hearing, or you may not be called. And once we hear about when that is scheduled, we'll let you know as soon as we can. Roughly,
I think Stacy and I were the last people who actually had to go present at the Senate.
Susan Burton did.
Oh, did she?
Oh,
that's right.
Never mind.
Can I just tell her she was real nervous?
Yeah.
So roughly, 3,000 bills have been filed. And the deadline to get the bills to Leds Council is Thursday on 2/17, so that was yesterday, right?
Oh, Thursday, yesterday.
And then the deadline to file a bill is March 10. So we, I think each agency will talk about where they are on the bills that they're involved in. All of y'all have received a letter from the governor about a hiring freeze. We will talk about that a little bit later. The letter is fairly clear that it only involves agencies that have appropriated funds, which we do not, but we will talk about how we're going to respond to that letter a little bit later. And I believe, Madam Chair, it's all on the operations.
Okay, thank you. Moving on to agenda item 5, which is the audit committee report. Molly?
Sure. Pursuant to sections 551.076 and 551.071, Texas Government Code, the audit committee entered an executive session for deliberations regarding security devices or security audits relating to the cybersecurity assessment report of the Office of the Consumer Credit Commissioner, and also consultation with our attorney that was attorney-client privilege. There was no final decision, vote, or recommendation of matters deliberated that were made during the executive session. Okay, the audit committee would like to make...
You did have a vote on the item H or item I?
Not within executive session.
No, yeah, but afterwards.
Afterwards, okay. Yes. So no final decision was made within executive session, and then we voted on it afterwards. Okay. The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Finance Commission's internal audit activity charter.
Coming upon recommendation from the audit committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion's adopted.
Okay. The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's fiscal year 2017 internal auditor's risk assessment and audit plan.
Coming upon recommendation from the audit committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion's adopted.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's November 30th, 2016 investment officer reports.
Coming upon recommendation from the audit committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion's adopted.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's 2017 first quarter financial statements.
Coming upon recommendation from the audit committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion's adopted.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the proposal for the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending to contribute one-time funds to the Texas Financial Education Endowment.
Coming upon recommendation from the audit committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion's adopted.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Molly. Again, our apologies for the very long, drawn-out, hard-work audit committee meeting. Nothing like giving a new member an instant initiation into the Finance Commission. You've been running since the moment you got here. Items 6, 7, and 8 will move to executive session, so that moves us to agenda item B, which is Department of Banking, which you'll find on page 17. Charles?
Some general items. Yesterday, we hosted in this room what is called Ask the Fed, where the Federal Reserve goes around the country, really, and gives these webinars, primarily on commercial real estate, what's going on in the market. So they brought in one of their economists, actually he's from the Atlanta Fed, talking about the commercial real estate in the Southwest, and biggest part is Texas. A very good presentation. We had four bankers attend from around the state, and I believe about 400 people we're in the webinar, but it's out there so others will see it. We are currently tracking about 170 bills. That may seem like a lot, but anything that would maybe involve banking in any form or fashion, or the agency in any form or fashion, we look at it, and those tracking are signed, and we have a primary and a secondary person to look at it. And anything happens on those bills, of interest, and we visit about that. We have five bills that we're working on, and all of those bills are in Ledge Council now. So far, so good. I had an op-ed about on January 22nd on The Hill, which is a publication in Washington, D.C. I don't know if we sent that out to the members or not. Okay, we'll send it out. It had to do with the meeting about the OCC coming up with they're going to issue a bank charter to non-banks, and it was my comments about that, and so I'll make sure y'all get that. It's just of interest. And then I had the opportunity. IBAT has their regional tour. I couldn't go on all the stops with them because I couldn't get up and down the stairs of the small plane, but I did participate in the one that they had in Waco and here in Houston, here in Dallas, which was very good. So if you will go to page 19, top of the column, our number of banks, we're down to 244, so the number continues to go down. The size continues to expand, and so you'll see some of the other items there. The other area that we always talk about are the number of 3, 4, and 5 banks, or problem banks, as we talk about. On the chart there, you have 12 as of today. We're up to 13. That increase from 7 to 13 is primarily because of the issue involving oil and gas. But that level at 13, if y'all remember, at our high mark, we were at 57, actually 58. So we're back in the, I guess you'd say, the kind of the what I would say would be normal. So there'll be a little bit of ebb and flow unless we have an unusual economic event. Following that number are on page 20. Our total administrative actions stand now at 26, so up a little bit, and the reason would be because we have an increase in problem banks, and we usually do some type of administrative action, whether it be public or informal. So that number's gone up a little bit. Bottom of the page 20, compliance with exam priorities. We're lagging behind a little bit on commercial. Our commercial banks, you will see that the reasons for that, we're behind 8. Two of those belong to the department responsibility. We're averaging 16 days behind there. 6 belong to the FDIC. But we will work on those. So far, we think we'll be able to complete everything. And I'm going to talk about vacancies in just a minute, so if you'll bear with me. On page 21, division highlights, I do mention oil and gas. Obviously, with West Texas Intermediate crude, I didn't check yesterday, but at 53, bouncing around between 50 and 55. Some activity has increased. We are monitoring 25 specific banks that have quite a bit of exposure to the energy sector, but the good thing is that the people that have been, the banks that have been kind of sticking to their practices and policies and procedures, while they may have a little bit of increase in problem loans, they're doing really well, and that's very positive. Let me go to page 23 on applications. Really, the detail is I want to go over is on page 24. Our applications in the money service business area has jumped compared to what it has been. on the chartering activities. As detailed there, the International Bank of Commerce in Laredo completed their movement of some of their branches in Oklahoma City, or excuse me, in the state of Oklahoma. They now have a bank in Oklahoma, a standalone bank in Oklahoma. And so our asset number there did decline, but then the State Bank of Texas in Dallas acquired a bank in Chicago, Illinois through an FDIC assisted. That's where a bank in Illinois failed. They do a bid process. Our bank won. That particular bank has other branches in Illinois. So some synergy there, so to speak. One of the trust companies, Family Legacy Trust Company out of Plano, completed its dissolution. I will say, I don't recall if I mentioned it last meeting, we have the first de novo application, new bank application filed, I think this year in the country. It's called Bank of Austin. It's been accepted for filing by the Department of Banking and also the FDIC, so we'll be moving into the evaluation stage. But that's activity in the de novo area is something that we really need, and very glad to have that application. Page 25 would be the special audit section, a lot of numbers there. Basically, the information is consistent with what we've had previously. On page 26, we have some past due, 21 past due MSB examinations, on average 1.85 past dues. Our performance measures for the first quarter, though, are we met those performance measures, so we're a little bit behind, but still working on that. In the division activities, we talked last time about La Mesa Memorial Park, and I think Catherine is going to talk about that in a little more detail in her legal report. I would like to mention this week here in Austin, the NMLS, nationwide licensing system, which CSBS oversees, had their conference here, and we had a lot of people, all three agencies had people attend. This is primarily for mortgage lenders, several other industries, money service businesses, debt collection, payday lenders are gravitating to this system. The system has been in existence, and we're moving to what we call NMLS 2.0, and several of our people participated in that. So this is something I think is really good for the industry, the industries. Care to say anything about that?
A 2.0, I'm hoping, is going to have some enhancements and improvements. And nothing like, yes.
Should
bring it on.
Should have some, should be user-friendly, too. Page 27, all of the our performance measures that we met for the first quarter. Beginning on page 28, let me mention this. Down at the bottom, we have a little chart about our departures. So as of when this was put together, on the right side, on the financial examiners, we had five resignations. As of today, we've had nine. And so you see the reasons. We've had a few people that have leave for other jobs, some in banking, some in the financial sector. I would say that to the person, one of the reasons, that the primary reason for leaving, if they went to work somewhere else, was travel. We have some areas that travel fairly consistently. And I would say that they matured such in their experience level that they became fairly, the companies wanted them. They had a lot of experience and were very valuable. So some of it I would call kind of normal activity. We are continuing to try to work on things to try to reduce travel time by off-site exams and things like that, but in some cases, travel is just part of the job. And filling those positions will be something that we'll have to consider because of the what we talked about with the governor's hiring freeze that we'll discuss later. Normal activity on our strategic support division and the complaints and everything, it's just really kind of normal. On page 33, I always want to mention Lonnie Lim Vegas, who is our financial education coordinator. She is always active, and she participated in the Small Business Administration webinar having to do with saving for retirement. Our Finance Commission website redesign is underway and in the building phase, and we hope to present that to you the spring of this year. So, Catherine, you want to come up and give the legal update?
Good morning, members. The legal division update begins on page 34 of your packet, and I really just wanted to bring to your attention three matters that are, two of which are coming to a close and one which is sort of rejuvenated, but all in a good way. The first matter is Myrtlewood Memorial Services, DBA Harlingen Combs Memorial Cemetery. This is a what I would characterize as kind of a continuing problem cemetery for us. It was a perpetual care cemetery. Their certificate of authority has expired. They have not been operating as a perpetual care cemetery. We have finally reached, I believe, an agreement with them to terminate the perpetual care trust fund. We're working with the bank to terminate the fund. The resolution of it would involve transfer of the trust fund to an instrument where the department would have co-signing authority. But we are hoping to bring this to a final resolution. It's been on our docket for way too long. We'll be glad to see it off. The next item on the list is...
So, I've been trying to get my head around this. So I think what we learned yesterday was that we have perpetual care cemeteries, but a lot of cemeteries in the state are not perpetual care, would be subject to our regulations. So I guess we're moving from category A to category B. Is that?
That's correct. And to move from category A to category B, it has to be within certain parameters. There are certain legal limitations on what you can do to not operate as a perpetual care cemetery. And if you are operating as a perpetual care cemetery, you have to have the trust fund in place, and the trust fund is inviolable, and the income from the fund is supposed to be sufficient to run the operations. A lot of these, unfortunately, are small cemeteries with interest rates being so low, there's just not sufficient income. So this one is one that meets the criteria to not be a perpetual care cemetery, and so we've agreed to move it out of that category. They will remove all of the signage. In fact, I think they have already removed the signage that said Perpetual Care Cemetery.
So if you decided to place your relatives in the cemetery based on the assumption that it was going to be a Perpetual Care Cemetery, and now it's not, what's the usual practice for the maintenance and upkeep of that facility going forward? Or do people who had relied on that, on the perpetual care nature of the cemetery, get some sort of notice so that they can have an annual cleanup of the cemetery? Or what? I mean, what's the consumer protection here?
Well, there is a notice. I believe it has already been published. There's a notice published in local media, and I mean, I think it probably depends on the particular cemetery. Uh-huh. This one, it's the same owner, the same individual that owned it as a perpetual care cemetery continues to own it. I guess good news is we have few or no complaints on the cemetery. I think it's a small community. I'm honestly not sure of the, you know, on the ground facts. I told her help a little bit. This is a cemetery that actually opted into perpetual care. It didn't have to be. They were under the 10-acre requirement. So when they opted in however many years ago to be perpetual care, they didn't even have to be. So that was one of the reasons that this one was a candidate for that, because they should have really not been under our regulation. And in terms of the fund, that's why we're trying to put the caveat that it is somewhat still under our control, because the amount of the fund, I think it's almost $100,000. That is what it is, and it's only going to make so much money. And right now, the trustee fees take more than the income. So at least if it's in a CD or some other kind of account that doesn't have those fees, the owner will have more money to use for the actual general care and maintenance of the cemetery. And there is numerous notices that we had to publish regarding this, if anyone wanted to come forward and disagree. I mean, we tried multiple ways to get new ownership as perpetual care, but it's just not profitable enough for someone to take it as a perpetual care.
I was just trying to get my head around what the, you know, consumer effects is sort of an odd way to describe.
Yes, yeah. There's also, there's going to be a public hearing on the termination of the status, and it's a, as I said, it's a public hearing. Anyone that wants to appear can absolutely appear at that hearing and object. We don't expect that, but it is their legal right to do so.
Thank you.
Sorry. Thank you. Any other questions about Myrtlewood? All right, the second matter, this one has not been on the docket as long, but it's, again, it's coming to a conclusion. This is Lamesa Memorial Park, located in Dawson County. This is the cemetery that had been transferred to new ownership, and unfortunately the new ownership, and when I say new, these individuals had been in place for less than a year. The two individuals ended up becoming incarcerated. The cemetery fell into severe disrepair. The grounds of the cemetery were unkempt. The office was in very poor shape. We established the receivership in September. Russell Reese has been doing an excellent job as the receiver. The court has been very accommodating to us in terms of quickly signing our proposed orders and status reports, talking about how the receivership has been administering the estate. We transferred ownership to the county. We looked at several private individuals or entities that might have been interested. We could not get a private entity to agree to take ownership of the cemetery. We got the Dawson County to take it over, and there was a hearing held on January 18th to formally transfer ownership of the cemetery from the private corporation to the county. The receivership has a couple of final outstanding bills, which have all been paid now, and I believe that the receivership, if it is not closed as of this moment, it will be probably within the next week.
Explain about the fund, on what happens there with the money.
The funds were transferred to the county in full, and that was one good piece of news that we got from the cemetery, was that the trust funds, I think there was a very minor shortage, but for the large part it was intact, so that full amount was transferred to Dawson County when they took ownership.
We talked about that, I think, last meeting. Russell talked a little bit, but that's a very bad situation that I think probably ended up about as good as we could get it completed.
Yeah, the county actually owned a cemetery that abutted the property, so it was a very logical fit for the community. So it was a positive ending, we think.
Is it common for counties to own cemeteries?
Yes, it is. It is
common.
The last matter that I wanted to mention to you is our claim in the estate of Felix Trevino Morales. Mr. Morales, we learned, I guess, about a year and a half ago that he had been selling prepaid funeral contracts without any license from us. He then passed away. We have been dealing with his daughter, who's the executrix of his estate. We had initially, we reviewed the contracts and we determined that there was about $12,500 worth of prepaid funeral contracts that were outstanding and needed to be fulfilled. Unfortunately, when we went to file our claim back in, I believe it was November, December, the estate was inactive at that point. It had been taken off the docket of the probate court. We've been monitoring that, and thanks to Brenna McGee, who's the staff attorney assigned to this, she was regularly monitoring probate court proceedings, found that it had been reactivated, and so we will be filing our claim in the probate court for the unpaid prepaid funeral contract amounts. And the good news there is, in the meantime, the executrix has fulfilled a few of those contracts, so the amount of our claim has been reduced to $11,715. But we'll be filing that claim, and hopefully we'll get that money back to the purchasers.
Just, is there money in the estate so that you expect you'll get it?
We don't know. We have not seen the inventory of the estate yet, but that's, I believe there is some money in the estate because it has gone back on the active probate docket. If I would expect that if there was not money in the estate, that it would have just gone away. So we saw that as a positive sign.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, unless there are any questions, that completes our report.
Okay, thank you. So
I've got a question. You said five bills that we're working on. Are those identified somewhere?
We talked about that in the last session.
October,
I mean, last meeting.
October and December.
Yeah, we talked about it previously, Hector. But we've got some cleanup bills, doing some modifications, improvements of some things, and then. We have one what we call it's an MS bill, which is an incubation bill, which is allows us to be able to grant a license to a smaller startup company if it's has some support of a larger company, which I guess would be kind of our response to the OCC's FinTech Charter. At least gives some of these smaller companies an opportunity, but we still are trying to make sure our consumers are protected. It's a really a fine balance, but mostly clean up in that.
I have a question, page 21. Temporary view assignments, kind of in the middle there. So y'all are bringing in field supervisors, I think, and bring them here for 10, 12 weeks at a time, so we provide them living quarters, et cetera?
Well, they're on per diem, and their hotels are paid for. We do this, it's for training, obviously. It gets people out in the field more knowledgeable of what we do here. It helps if we have vacancies that we need to fill. We have people that at least know a little bit about what goes on in the headquarters. But as far as the cost of that, a lot of these people are on the road anyway, so the cost of being in Dallas versus being in Huntsville, Texas may be offset.
So do they do their job from here, or are they in training the whole time?
Well, they're not. They're doing they are taking actions that we have here, things that are done here by what we call review examiners. They're taking part of that load. And so they're actually working through the various projects that we have here in headquarters. There's sometimes that they have things that they're doing back in their regional office that they have to complete, but they're physically here.
Okay, thank you.
I think it's great, we just started that.
Our third person coming, doing the rotation now.
It's really, I think, really helps on training and trying to get everybody more knowledgeable about what we do.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
And I didn't, for those of you following the agenda, we skipped over item two just because that was on the consent, which was reappointing Wallace Jones to the Guarantee Fund, because it was a reappointment. It was on the consent agenda because he's been on before. But in case you would like to read about him, it's on page 37. Moving on to savings and mortgage lending, which starts on page 39. Caroline?
Yes, certainly. Our report content begins on page 40. With regard to the thrift industry, when we give you our financial data, that's coming from the FDIC, and there are some meetings at which that information is not available in time to bring it to you. So this meeting, that's what happened. That happens every once in a while. So what we'll do is at the April meeting, we'll report to you on the 2016 fourth quarter figures for the state savings bank industry. The number of savings banks, their composite ratings, and enforcement actions remain the same. And there is no further information on the acquisition of Capital Bank by Sunflower Bank in Kansas. On page 41, this is the time of year that we set the fees for the assessments for the state savings bank. The first chart is what they are currently. The second chart is what we're recommending for the next year. The benchmark for state savings bank assessments is 50% of the assessments of the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. And the reason why the OCC is the benchmark is because they regulate federal savings associations. And so when the state savings bank was enacted, the commissioner at that time decided that it would be appropriate to benchmark off 50% of that agency. And so we've consistently done that since that time. Sometimes the OCC leaves their assessments the same. Sometimes they raise them. This year what they have done is adjust for inflation of 1.2%. So the second chart is our recommendation for annual fee assessments based on the OCC's assessments as adjusted. And as a reminder, during the budget process, we budgeted to waive the fourth quarter in total for the state savings bank. So it would be these assessments for three quarters. And we are looking for a vote.
Do I hear a motion to approve the annual assessments to be paid by the Texas State Savings Banks?
So moved.
Will?
Second.
Is there a second?
Second.
Lori? Any discussion?
Have we voted on this entire year?
You have not, but from our
current... This is new, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And from our current reading of the regulations, we believe it is prudent for you all to be voting on them.
Because I had a discussion with Doug about the analysis of why, you know, we voted on the Department of Banking, mm-hmm. and we didn't vote on his, and he was pretty clear that his reading of the regulation didn't require voting, because I was sort of urging that we should. And so what's the change in the analysis?
The change in the analysis is that I asked us to go back and look at that. And our analysis under me is that we do need the vote. And so
good. I'm for it.
Thank you. Yes.
Any other discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion's adopted.
Thank you. Page 42, we move into the mortgage division. Licensing, as you heard yesterday from Stephen O'Shields, renewal period was 11-1 to 12-31. We're currently in reinstatement until 2/28. For those who did not timely renew, if they want to reinstate their license, this is the time. Once this month finishes, they would have to come back and apply anew for a totally new license. As of January 31st, we had received 307 reinstatement requests. For comparison purposes, last year on that same time, we had received 320. The current license population is in your materials. I want to compare it for you again to last year at this same time, as of 1/31/16, to the chart that shows you 1/31/17. So under entities, in 16, it would have been 1,607 branches, 2,421, and individual MLOs, 19,425. So there is an increase, not large, but there's continuing to be an increase. To put that into context across the country, The NMLS system provides information as to the top five states with regard to number of licensees. It's consistent that California is number one, and then Texas SML and Florida vie for 2 and 3. So the last information available was September 30th of 16. California had the most number of individual licensees. Texas SML was next, and then Florida. When we look at that same chart with regard to companies, same date, California number one, Florida number two, Texas SML number three. So we're a big player in this arena in the state of Texas. I'm gonna go on to mortgage examinations. The first quarter of 17 numbers from the numbers of the exams we've conducted are in the materials. We continue to have as our top violations in exams unlicensed activity, which means someone who has never been licensed in the mortgage industry in Texas is originating loans. And we also still have a lot of unauthorized activity. Unauthorized being they've been in the business, they're changing sponsors, sponsorship hasn't been approved and accepted, and they originate loans. Not as egregious as unlicensed activity, but a violation nonetheless. And then we still have issues with the conditional qualification letters that they have to use and approval letters. And the issues are generally they're incomplete or they contain only a minimum of the required information. So those are the main categories of violations that we're seeing in exams. Complaints, excuse me, on page 43, the first chart shows the aging of open complaints as of the end of first quarter of 17. There were 69 open complaints, and none of them were over 120 days old. The second chart shows the nature of open complaints at the same date, and the majority of them were loan servicing, which is the same thing we tell you every time, because since fiscal year 11, or maybe 12, the loan servicing has been the highest in terms of the complaints that we receive. But in 14, they spiked up to around 60%, and they've hovered around 59 to 60, 62 ever since. And then on page 44, the nature of complaints received at the end of first quarter of 17, same thing, loan servicing, 60%. I want to mention the other items category, because I want you to give some context into what this portion of the materials is and why we report them to you. We speak on a regular basis to mortgage professional groups. Many of them have local chapters with monthly meetings. Last week I spoke to the Texas Mortgage Roundup. In a few weeks I'm speaking to another mortgage group. I speak annually to the TMBA board, and then we have Mortgage Industry Day. And we do that because it allows us an opportunity to give the industry, direct from us, education and information about these violations. Like when we speak about exams, I go into much more detail about what we're seeing done wrong, what suggestions we have, or best practices from our viewpoint so that they can comply. Because our perspective is we want all of these people to comply with the rules and regulations, because our mission is to protect consumers in their mortgage lending transactions from origination to the end of servicing when they've gotten a release of their lien. And anything that we can do to help educate and inform helps us to do that. It helps them to be in compliance. So, on the performance measures on page 45, we met or exceeded all of our measures and expect to continue doing that, anticipated continuing to do that. Item number 4, fiscal operations. The audits were all reported in the audit committee portion. Under staffing, last meeting we gave you the full report on first quarter. Next meeting we'll give you full report on second quarter. I do want to update you in terms of turnovers to date from the meeting from first quarter till now. We have not yet had any turnover and don't anticipate having any. Last meeting we had one planned retirement, but no changes since then. And then under legal, We've had no new SOA decisions. There are no gifts to report. The Catherine Sims litigation has had no further developments since September of 2016. And with regard to legislation, you get our weekly Finance Commission report. We're monitoring many more bills than that that relate to state agencies and could potentially relate to our industries. We did recommend several statutory amendments that we presented to you all in October. Those are in varying stages of preparation. And we're providing input on a variety of bills that we're asked to be a resource on. And we're awaiting being called for committee hearings. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you.
We will move on to Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner, which starts on page 47. Leslie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the detail starts on page 48, starting with the Consumer Protection and Assistance section of the report. And so we'll first discuss where we are on examinations. And you'll see for the first 4 months of fiscal year 17, a report at the bottom page, a chart at the bottom of page 48, which gives you a breakdown of where we are on our compared to the prior year on those types of examinations. You'll see significant concentration of activity on motor vehicle sales finance as we've really focused our efforts prioritizing that activity in the first part of the fiscal year. The other groups are running a little bit behind, but actually they're running right on point with where they were in the prior fiscal year. Overall, if you look at our aggregate numbers, we're within 1% of our pro rata goal for the year. And Rudy talked to you yesterday again about some of what those total numbers look like year to year. So it seems like we're on track for examination activity, at least presently. On page top of page 49, you can look at acceptable levels of compliance. And this is, again, just a snapshot from the first 4 months of the fiscal year. But things seem to be running in a pretty positive direction. I'm pleased with where our rates of compliance are for the first 4 months. At the bottom of page 49, you'll see when you add in the rest of the trailing 12 months, we still have a couple of areas. Those will take a while to hopefully work out of the system. If we can continue to see good rates of compliance, especially dealing with some of these follow-ups, that's a good sign that we're getting some of those people back into compliant levels. But that gives you some more perspective on how we're approaching the acceptable level of compliance. On page 50, it's information on investigations, and we've had quite a bit of activity the first 4 months of the year compared to the prior year. Our investigations are up about 30% over the prior year. Again, most of that activity is in motor vehicle sales finance. That's where we're seeing some focus of activity. Counter to that, which is a little bit surprising at the moment, is our complaints. And our complaints are down 23% compared to the prior period. And so, again, those are down in motor vehicle sales finance. And usually when you have a reduction of complaints, it's a good thing. So we will see if that trend continues. We did just recently launch our new online complaint portal. So consumers can file complaints directly online. They populate into the system. There's workflow associated with it where we'll be investigators or the consumer service technicians that are working on those complaints. They'll appear directly in their dashboard, and there's some cool interactive activity that will happen related to those types of complaints. When we request information from licensees, that'll all be handled through the system. So we're excited about that.
Can I ask a question on that?
Sure.
On the new complaint portal, is there any way that you can tie some sort of trigger mechanism to take them to a financial literacy course? Because it's my experience from around the country that many of the complaints are based on ill-informed consumers. Mm-hmm. And so that would be an excellent time to offer them some of this financial literacy that we're spending so much time on.
Well, that's a great point. And there's probably through some of our communication with them, they initially get some information from us just mostly about complaint procedures, but we could probably layer in the complaint process some more resources for financial education. And we haven't done that yet, and that's a great idea. We'll look and see if we can incorporate that. That's a great idea. Page 51 gives you our, you know, top complaint issues and what people are complaining about. Those are fairly consistent as we continue to report that to you. And then page 52 is that ratio of complaints to the population levels. This is one of those charts. I'm not sure if this continues to provide the commission with useful information. I welcome any feedback on that if you think that's useful. If it's not useful, we can move on from it to something else. But anyway, I solicit that from you at any time. On page 53, is information on our reporting from our credit access businesses, and as fourth quarter reports were recently due, we have a lot of work to do before we're ready to give you the aggregate information for the year end, but we're certainly working on that with good speed. The other kind of important issue, not only did we just go online with the complaint module, but now our new automated reporting module for all of the industries that have to report business data, that is now live and all industries are filing through that system. And our first reports were just due February 1st from the debt management company. So far, so good. And that's pretty exciting for us. That'll help us. We think it'll help provide more accurate, better information. It should be easy to use for the industry, and it will help us to turn around aggregate reporting on a much faster. So we're excited about the opportunities that holds for us. Page 54, we'll talk about licensing real quick. As you have heard, we've been through similar renewal periods with a number of our industries that have to renew. And we saw a couple of surprising results out of our renewals. One in particular was we had forecasted a much lower percentage of credit access businesses that were going to renew and keep their licenses. We thought that would probably be somewhere in the range of about 85%. And when we got through with renewal period, about 95% renewed their licenses. So, and we're seeing some renewed interest in activity in the credit access business area. So,
what do you attribute that to, Commissioner?
Some of it, I think there's some sense that things may be a little bit different. I think folks feel there's some uncertainty around what may happen with potential rules with the CFPB. I mean, there's just some renewed interest, I think, in a few areas. But folks are kind of hanging in there, not more so when it appeared that they may be beginning to sort of attrition out. So it's hard to say exactly what it is, but that seems to be the predominant things. Folks are feeling a little bit differently about what may come out of those rules. Our residential mortgage loan originator group renewed at a much lower rate than we had expected. We certainly felt there was going to be some attrition. There normally is for that group for us, a fairly significant level, but it was an even higher level of attrition than we expected. But again, they are also in the late renewal period, so sometimes those come through. But there is quite a bit of turnover within that industry, so we'll see kind of what happens for those throughout the year. On the chart on page 55, you'll see the dashboard of all of our industries and how their outstanding licensing levels, how those reflect throughout this to this period within the first quarter. I just note the bottom chart on page 55 on the right, all regulated entities is still hit a new high at 36,611 when you put them all together. That will probably dip back down a little bit next quarter, because we do see, especially if you look to the left, bottom left, the registration count is up fairly high at 8501. That's right before their renewal period, and they will usually, again, there's some turnover. We'll see probably a little dip in the second quarter because of non-renewals in that group. But just wanted to kind of give you all a little more insight into those that information. On page 56, we have some comments about the legislative session. I probably have a little more updated information since the report was prepared. I just wanted to let you know that Senate Bill 560 was filed by Senator Hancock, Chairman Hancock, who's chair of the Business and Commerce Committee in the Senate. But that contains our agency recommendations regarding the transfer of the credit card surcharge prohibition enforcement to the Attorney General's office, consistent with what happened with the debit card surcharge prohibition last session. So that has been filed, and we think it will be filed also in the House sometime soon. But we'll keep working on that. We've worked with the Attorney General's office on that issue, and that seems to be moving along just fine. Overall, we're tracking a number of bills around 230, 235 right now and counting. The bills continue to be filed, and we're certainly, we've got a few more weeks ahead of bill filing before we kind of reach what the peak of that will be. We track ours through a number of different legislative tracks related to the subject matter. If some of you are interested in more expanded review of bill tracks than what you already get from us, we do publish a publication that relates to interest rates on a weekly basis, but we also have general items of interest to creditors, general credit, general lending issues, and we run some information on bills filed and just status of those bills on that that publication as well. I'd be happy to put you on the distribution list if you'd like to see that, but some of you probably already have plenty of bills to review as it is, so but that's out there if you'd like that. Moving on to stakeholder outreach and communication, we've also been fairly busy giving presentations to the industry and just different groups or consumer groups for that matter. We've done about a dozen presentations from September through January, and we continue. We appreciate those opportunities. Those are good opportunities for us to talk with members of the industry and continue to emphasize a culture of compliance within their organizations and things to look for. And so those are good opportunities. In terms of HR, you'll see on page 58 our separations for the fiscal year. Actually, last week that's now going to increase by one more, so we'll be up to three separations for the fiscal year. But similar reasons as Commissioner Cooper mentioned, travel on the financial examiners continues to be a challenge or concern. But we do what we can to help try to make that as good as we can. And we're actually working, Rudy and his supervisors are working to see if they can make any adjustments in travel and scheduling in ways that we can help with some of those travel accommodations. Page 59, I've mentioned a couple of items already on our legacy modernization and on ITU, but I just want to mention one more issue, and that is our exam and exam scheduling and our legal modules that we've been working on, the new functionality. And those are expected. Folks are getting training. We've been through a whole lot of testing, and we expect that our go-live date for those, that last functionality piece, but the largest functionality piece, will happen on February 22nd. So we are looking forward to that. And those new opportunities and what comes from that. That should be pretty exciting for us. Moving on, performance measures on page 61, and most of those are over and above with the exception of the last one on consumers receiving financial education. That's been sort of a timing issue. We expect to catch up steam on that later on. in terms of the legal report, Iman covered a number of these issues for you yesterday, so I think you kind of understand what some of the activity on the performance targets there. I did want to mention on page 66, and Matt's available if you want more detailed questions, but I'm sorry, 65, I jumped too fast. The PHH Corporation versus the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, we've just been giving you some additional information about this case. And the latest report had been that the CFPB had filed a petition for rehearing en banc with the D.C. Circuit, and that petition was granted yesterday. So the D.C. Circuit Court will be rehearing, the entire court will be rehearing that case. And then beyond that, we can answer any questions. I think that's the...
Back on page 56, first paragraph, Senator Kelly Hancock, and I think... Charles mentions too, is the person's oversight of the agency. Who is it on the House side? And I think you mentioned it, I didn't catch it.
Chairman Parker.
Dan Parker.
Tan.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Just an observation, Commissioner Petty John. On the page 58, you're talking about the financial literacy and that with that fund that we have set aside, we've educated 61 Texas consumers.
That's not through that fund. So that in that fund, we are only awarding grants to outside organizations that support those. So that's a sort of a grant program. So this is out of our agency budget, and what we do, sort of getting out. We do a lot more really in promoting, facilitating, working with groups. I mean, there's not a lot of, it's not set up to be a lot of just direct training for consumers and financial education, but we do try to do some of that and keep that current. We try to do a lot more sort of on a broad basis of promoting and assisting other groups and their educational efforts. And
I guess this is just an observation and a commentary, but you know, there's challenges to get the financial literacy out to the masses, and the school districts are typically the best source to train the
yes.
current users of their products.
Yes.
And for our existing consumers that are using our products, there's not any set source. And so I guess my frustration is that when the consumer advocate groups come out there and start complaining and looking at the number of complaints and so forth, there's all this financial literacy out there available to them, and we just have to make that connection a little bit more prevalent to those individuals. And I know it's a difficult task, because I've ran into this for the last 15 years trying to educate our consumers over and over again. But there has to be something that, as a body that we represent of the Texas Finance Commission, that we need to make sure those resources. I know JumpStart and MoneySkill are excellent
right.
programs
right.
that we can put in the school districts, but the teaching is not allowed to do that. The teaching system platform is all geared towards the achievement test.
Right.
And so that hour of curriculum spent on financial literacy is not a priority any longer. And I think that's a disservice to our students and our population as a general.
But over the last 3 to 4 years, there's been some additional elements within the essential knowledge and skills components that do relate to financial literacy. And so I suppose it's a longer term goal, but we get a little credit in Texas, I think, because we have at least some of those elements within specifically in the secondary school education, but I believe there's some actually in K through 8 as well, or K through 6 or K through 5, whatever.
I guess my point is that there's so many resources out there yep. that are paid for by
right.
one segment of the yep. industry or another, that we as a body should find a better use to get that to the consumer and to help offset the complaints that the consumer advocates and the other third party groups are saying about these
yep.
industries, which is primarily put upon the consumer to educate themselves. I think
right.
we have to force that on.
Right. We've found a couple of things. I just want to make a couple of comments relative to your statement. The K through 12, I believe, is really important, and where we can get that, especially in the secondary level, and that there, you know, we continue to look for opportunities to see how different school districts approach this and what curriculums they use. And it's a little bit like turning the big ship, but trying to at least continue to gain information, and so that those resources are more readily available and that there's opportunities for those teachers. And some of the programs the TV grant has supported has been some of the programs to train the trainers for the teachers to ensure that they're using some of those good programs out there in the school districts. And so I think that's the more training the teachers have, the better off they'll be able to work with that. But we're looking at, are there opportunities that we can help at least make sure people have access to or are aware of some of those good curriculums out there. So that's one of the issues that I think would be important.
My personal experience working with the state of Idaho on this issue is that we've gone to some of the different charitable organizations and worked through industry and to do a trainer program and Gavin Gee, the commissioner
yep.
up there, and Mike Larson have been very, very
yep.
instrumental in doing that. And so I think there's opportunities for the industry to continue to help educate the consumers, but we need somebody to help facilitate that, because
yeah.
the complaints obviously are there,
yeah.
and if we can start chiseling away those complaints with an educated program for the consumer, I think we would,
yeah.
everybody would win.
There's been some troubling research lately about the effect of, you know, how effective some of the education has been at the secondary school level, and one of the things that we have observed through our time has been the most effective time to deliver financial education is when the consumer is sort of at that point of need, when they're about to buy that car, or when they're about to buy that house, and that's sometimes the most effective way But, you know, how you continue to look at some of the strategies and the research material to see how can we continue to impact, whether that's adult education. Some of the research has been really positive about financial coaching, which is, again, one of the reasons that the grant program is supporting that. But I agree with you. It's a super difficult problem, and there's not enough that we can all do collectively, but we want to continue to do our part. And I had a meeting with our financial education specialist just this, actually this week, Wednesday. We talked about some of the longer-term strategies and what visions we could do to continue to help support that. And I know the other agencies are working on issues as well. We all are. It's just a very large problem. So
I apologize. That's a little bit of a hot-button issue for well, many of the industry groups that are targeted, you know, quite constantly.
Well, I appreciate your passion and your interest, and I assure you I share it, and I hope we can long-term, you know, kind of collectively work together to create a better vision to really address some of that need.
Thank you. Leslie, let's go back and revisit, I think, a conversation maybe you and I have had, which is the education commissioner has something like 35 programs already approved to meet the qualifications of curriculum to be taught in that social studies segment on financial education.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are there. I don't know that we've ever actually reviewed them mm-hmm. to make sure they're effective and efficient. But, you know, to me, asking for proposals from people about what they offer to come in and give grants may not be the best way to get what we want done. It may be that we want to think about what would we like to see accomplished and try to get somebody to do that rather than getting ideas from them.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we, you know, it may be that what they offer isn't going to meet the needs that Philip and others have suggested. So just sort of a recasting of how we think about maybe going out and actually soliciting, trying to find somebody who will do research. I mean, maybe it's a college professor that we get to do a research study mm-hmm. on what we do. Something other than just asking charitable organizations. I'm not saying those aren't good too.
Yeah.
But trying to find out some other way to efficiently and effectively deliver education to consumers who need it is good. You know, I've been on a bit of a mission to try to see if we can do that in conjunction with the retail food banks,
right?
Who get people who are in crisis financially every day through their doors, and so figuring out how to use that as a vehicle to provide the education is another place to go. But
and we've done some work reaching out to them as well.
Yeah.
And,
I know.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, I just, you know, going forward on this, I hope we sort of continue to do a good job of sort of thinking outside the box, if you will, about how to best use those funds.
Certainly. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay. At this time, the Finance Commission will enter into executive session in accordance with the applicable sections of the Government Code. No final action, decision, or vote with regard to a matter deliberated in executive session will be made until the Commission reconvenes in an open meeting. The time is now 11:23, and we anticipate we will be in executive session for approximately 40 minutes. Okay, time is now 11:56, and we are back in open session. In accordance with Section 551.102 of the Open Meetings Act, no final action, decision, or vote on matters deliberated was made during executive session. Members, anything else that we'd like to discuss today? Hopefully not. And if so, there being no further business, this meeting of the Finance Commission is now adjourned, and the time is 11:57. Thank you.